So today we're looking at Dhammapada verse 287, which reads as follows. Tang putta pasu sammatang biasata manasang narang sutang sutang gamang mahogowa machu adaya gacchati, which means that person with a mind of craving attached to children and livestock like a great flood, a sleeping village, death takes them away. So this verse was taught to Kisa Gotami. Now, Kisa Gotami's story we've already looked at. It's already come up in the Dhammapada once. But to recap, Kisa Gotami was a young woman who married into a rich family. And was unappreciated, as it was said, due to her lack of ability to have a child. So, for her own self-worth was lacking. Her own sense of self-worth was lacking, and her estimation in the eyes of her in-laws was quite low, until finally she did give birth to a young male child, gave birth to a baby, and was from then on esteemed quite highly by her family, and in her own mind put all of her self-worth into the care of the child. And it happened, as these things from time to time do, that when the baby grew up and was just at the point where it began to walk, it died through some unspecified means. Sickness or an accident, it doesn't say. And unsurprisingly, Kisa Gotami was devastated. Probably on two fronts. She was devastated because of her own attachment to the child, but also devastated because of how lost it made her, and how much importance she had put on the existence of the child in terms of her own self-worth. And so she was unable to come to terms with the reality of the loss of her child. And she carried the child around trying to find someone who could cure her baby of this condition of being dead. And so she went from town to town, house to house, town to town, went wandering around looking for someone who could cure her child, and was unsurprisingly ridiculed wherever she went, until she met a fairly wise individual, doesn't say who, who understood that really there might be someone who could help her. The help that she needed wasn't the help she was seeking, perhaps, but there was someone who could give her the help that she needed. And so he said, "Oh, I know someone who can help you." And this wise person sent her to the Buddha. and said, "There's someone who can help you." And so immediately she thought, this must be someone who can give her the medicine she needs for her child. So she went to the Buddha and respectfully asked him for some way to, some means to cure her child. And the Buddha said, "I can help you. But first you must bring me a mustard seed." And of course, Kisa Gotami thought, well, that's not difficult. Of course, absolutely, I will right away bring you some mustard seed. And he said, the Buddha said, "Oh, but this mustard seed must come from a family, must come from a household whose family has not had anyone die." So a little bit tricky there. You have to go around and find, has to be specifically that a family where no one has died. And right away, Kisa Gotami was excited and set off to find the mustard seed. The idea being here from the Buddha, of course, if you can understand it, was that it was clear that Kisa Gotami didn't have a deep understanding of death. There was a sheltered quality to her life, and this was a means of providing her with a sort of a roundabout lesson, rather than just telling her outright, "Your son is dead, he's not coming back. Death isn't a reversible condition." He gave her the opportunity to learn for herself. And so she went from house to house and asking for mustard seed and said, but first, has anyone died in this, in your family? And the answer was always, yes, my mother has died, my father has died, even my grandmother, my grandfather, sisters, brothers, children even. And so she got to hear everyone's story, the stories of all these people, about the reality of life. This is the way of the world. It's happening all around us constantly. As we travel through life year after year, again and again we meet with the realities of life, one of which is death. And so gradually, story after story changed and opened the mind of Kisa Gotami, until eventually she, of her own will, took her son to the charnel ground and laid his body down, abandoning it, giving it up. After doing this, she continued on her way and returned back to the Buddha, paid homage to the Buddha, and immediately asked, didn't even talk about the lesson, asked permission to become a bhikkhuni, to ordain under the Buddha in the Buddha Sasana. The Buddha gave her permission and she became a sotapanna. And the Buddha taught her this verse, saying, "Indeed, you were foolish and naive to think that this is not the way of the world. This is the way of the world. We are all asleep, and asleep chasing after our desires and caught up in attachments. Death comes like a flood coming to a village in the middle of the night when everyone's asleep and just washes it away." So the story of Kisa Gotami, it's a very famous one, very popular, mostly for the cleverness of the Buddha's methods of teaching. But it's a great lesson, a great reminder as to the inevitability of death and our inability to come to terms with it. So the first lesson, I think, is this attachment to something like a son. These are the sorts of attachments that we all have coming into this life as we grow up. We develop these attachments to people. We develop attachments to identity, our own identity, attachments to wealth and possessions. And it's not just attachment in terms of liking. There is obviously this attachment in terms of what we like. There's also attachment in terms of meaning and value. This is a different level of attachment that we find in the story of Kisa Gotami, where her whole sense of self-worth, her identity, became that of a mother. She was no longer a woman with her own agency and her own future. She was now the caretaker, and her whole identity became that of a mother. I mean, that seems to have been the case. And this is, of course, a reality for many people in the world, where we pour ourselves into something. It can be motherhood, it can be an employment, a job, it can be ambitions and projects. Even monks can have these identities, wanting to be a great teacher, wanting to be famous. Meditators can have these as well, wanting to be enlightened, wanting to be even wanting to be peaceful and calm, and having holding something up as being important, being meaningful, being attached to these things. This is not attachment of craving. That, of course, is an issue, but this is attachment of views, attachment of beliefs. When you believe something to be important, and you hold on to it. Of course, there are things that we should believe are important and hold on to, but they're really very few. You can boil them down to ethics, concentration, wisdom, and freedom. Freedom and the knowledge of being free. These are the five things that the Buddha said are Sara Dhamma. They're truly essential, truly meaningful. So much else is not so meaningful. And one of the big reasons why we can see that it's not so meaningful is this reality of death. That no matter what else you can say about the meaningfulness, the goodness, the value of things, anything that is circumscribed with death loses an incredible amount of meaning and value, potential meaning, potential value by that very fact. So a child, putting your whole identity or meaning or value or happiness into the happiness of your children, for example, is not just dangerous, it's kind of absurd. And it's only absurd when you put it in the perspective of things like death. I mean, it's not just the reality of death, it's that death is coming in a very, very short time. Anyone who is very lucky might live to 100 years nowadays. That's incredibly lucky. But 100 years put in perspective is nothing. Is a blink of an eye. The devas, the angels up in heaven who live much, much longer, find it absurd. There's a story of an angel who remarked how absurd humans are in that we just waste all our time and neglect to do anything of any real value when we only live for 100 years, if we're lucky. It's that, oh, this is such, they have such short lives. Now, as humans, we think 100 years is so long and we can put things off, and when we get really old, then we can do lots of good things when we have no more strength and our faculties are dull, right? But it's such a short time. Putting things in perspective is an incredibly valuable aspect of Buddhist practice. And one of the best ways to do that is to remind ourselves of the inevitability of death. That no matter what, in not so long a time, we are going to die. So anything in at all that you might be clinging to or holding on to or seeking after that is going to be limited by that death is really very limited indeed. It's a great way of helping us to realign our priorities and give up many of the things that are keeping us from what is really important, many of the things that keep us from meditation, keep us from the practice. So we're being reminded of death. I mean, we can take the example of Kisa Gotami as someone who was completely clueless, thought that maybe death could be undone. No, that's how naive and hope. Now, most people are not that naive, but we do, for the most part, trivialize or ignore or avoid the topic of death. And it's not that we want to be somehow negative or focus on the negatives. It's just a really great way of putting things in perspective. Anything that you seek out, you can ask yourself, is this going to be limited by death? Of all things, you only have to ask this one question. Because ultimately, if the answer is yes, then that ambition, that pursuit, that attachment is not just dangerous, it's futile. The loss, of course, is more immediate. Kisa Gotami suffered a great loss. Most people don't suffer such a great loss. There are people who do, but the odds are we are not going to lose a child if we have children. The odds are that we're going to die first. So that's the danger. There's always the gamble that you might suffer, but no matter what, you are going to die. And so your attachment to things like children, it's such a trivial thing. And we put so much emphasis. Parents are so devastated, not just by death of their children, by the separation of from their children, even sickness or any kind of trouble that their child might have. And this is a person who you've only known for a handful of years, even if it's 10, 20, 30, 40 years. It's nothing. How many times have you been born and gotten old and sick and died crying over the same things? The third lesson, so the first lesson, the first lesson again is just a reminder that we should put things in perspective, that we should be very careful, and a big part of our practice is to recognize our attachment. And the second, of course, is the inevitability of death and being cognizant or conscious of the reality and the inevitability of death. The third lesson is the positive lesson, that Kisa Gotami is someone to be not ridiculed, but to be praised. Not just, because she became a Sotapanna, but even putting that aside, her immediate decision to ordain as a bhikkhuni, to become an ordained student of the Buddha. This was the solution to her situation that she ultimately came to, which takes an incredible greatness of mind. But something worth remarking upon and worth reminding ourselves of, considering, in many cases, without this avenue presented to us, we are at a loss for how to proceed. Often we turn to substance abuse. People will become alcoholics, drug addicts, in an attempt to free themselves from the pain and suffering of such devastating loss. They will pour themselves into worldly pursuits or just generally be at a loss of what to do, not having any clue the correct response to loss of a loved one, loss of your identity, loss of meaning, having to grapple with the truth of life that we have to give up everything that we hold dear. Now, Kisa Gotami correctly understood that which is of value has nothing to do with things like children or possessions or worldly pursuits. And so her decision was something for us all to take as an example. Now, for many people, the opportunity to ordain does not come, putting on robes, going through the ceremony of actually becoming a monk. But the point is that many people do come many people in, you know, watching these videos and coming to listening to this talk here have made the decision to dedicate themselves to something like an ordination. It's not about putting on robes or going through a ceremony. It's actually doing the practice. So those of you who come to the center and undertake the meditation course, this is something to be praised and appreciated very much. You've, for whatever reason, decided, come to the conclusion correctly that this is that which is actually valuable, actually meaningful. You put aside so much just to do this, just to practice. You put aside your worldly pursuits, making money. You put aside your family and your relationships. You've given up connection with the world, at least temporarily, to correctly focus on that which is truly meaningful, your own self-development, the cultivation of your own good qualities, and your own freedom from attachment to things that cannot possibly satisfy you. So the lesson here is about seeking out that which is of true value. Kisa Gotami came to the Buddha and asked for instruction on the Dhamma. The Buddha didn't go to her trying to teach her. He didn't even teach her when she came. He gave her the opportunity to learn for herself, and she took that opportunity and came back to him and said, give me the chance. And he gave it to her, and she took it, and she ran with it. For the verse, the main lesson is also about attachment and about what is truly important. But the verse reminds us, as previous verses have, that the nature of attachment, of desire, of clinging, is that it puts you to sleep, or not exactly, it keeps you asleep. It's like being asleep. A person who is seeking after or indulging in their attachments is not just not seeing the truth. They're unable to see the truth, like a person who is asleep. Like a village that is asleep will never even know that the flood is coming. Attachment, craving, clinging, it blinds us. Even if we're told about the truth, we cannot appreciate it, because our minds are drunk, intoxicated on the desire, on the pleasure of getting what we want. One of the great values of coming to the forest is that you take yourself away from such pleasures, such addictions, and you have come to live in a kuti with just the bare bones. You just have your bed and washroom if you're lucky. And one of the greatnesses of that is it's like a detox from all of the sources of attachment, sources of pleasure. So it's a great environment to focus on yourself and to look at the qualities of mind, both good and bad, that we have inside, unadulterated, without anything to distract us from the simple cultivation of awareness and understanding and wisdom. And this is why enlightenment is often described as awakening. The word for enlightenment, bodhi, comes from the root meaning to wake, to awaken. So it's often translated as awakening, enlightenment, awakening. Very different words that basically mean the same thing. But when you think of it as awakening, it's about being alerted to the nature of reality. Like a person who wakes up and sees the flood coming and gets out of the village. This is how it feels like in the practice of mindfulness. One of the great things about mindfulness is how it feels like being awake, seeing things you just didn't notice before, things that you could never intellectualize. For example, quite simply, the three characteristics. Such a core part of Buddhism, and something that is a subject of great amount of intellectual pursuit. people who learn about it try to understand them intellectually and might even think that they've come to an understanding. Usually have a hard time with ideas like non-self, even suffering, understanding the nature of it, but can never truly understand these things without the practice of mindfulness. And yet, as soon as you immediately upon beginning to cultivate mindfulness, you're confronted with the three characteristics from the very beginning and are constantly faced with the reality of these things that are so clearly evident. It's not that they're not there for us to see, it's that our minds are not clear enough to see them. This is the difference between being asleep and being awake. The other part of this the verse is simply the in regards to the reality of death, is that it's inevitable like a flood. Just great imagery, something to remind us that death is not something we can bargain with, not something that is up for debate. And it's not something that you can stall. Obviously not something that you can negate or deny, but also not something that you can stall or meet on your own terms. Death comes when it's going to come on its own terms. And quite often that's completely unexpected. Often when our plans are not fully realized, when we're not ready to go. And so a big part of Buddhist discourse is framed around the idea of being ready to die. Not hastening it, but asking yourself whether you are ready for this. The idea is to be ready for anything. The idea is that someone who is enlightened is ready for anything, because nothing has any extra significance. Everything is merely more and more experiences. So an enlightened being is not bothered by anything. Everything is the same. Everything is seen just as it is, without any color or judgment or partiality. But a great way to ask how you are doing is to ask whether you're ready to die. Because there's very little else that is of such great consequence. Any kind of suffering you might have in this life, as bad as it might be, doesn't have the same consequences as a death met with unmindfulness. Because if you're unmindful at the moment of death, obviously the next moment is going to be one based on that, and future existence is going to be determined based on the quality of mind at the moment of death. So a very important part of our reflective practice, as we reflect on reasons for cultivating mindfulness and reflect on what is truly important, death is a huge part of that conversation. Of course, at the moment of practice, you don't have to be thinking about conventional death. You just focus on the reality of birth and death of experiences. Because ultimately, again, that's just, in an ultimate sense, that's all death is. Death is not intrinsically different. It's just a single experience. And the moment after that, after death, is again just another experience. And these experiences continue one after another until we free ourselves from our attachment to cultivating further experiences, and we don't cultivate more becoming. When we stop cultivating becoming, then there's no more birth, and thus no more old age, sickness, and death. So a valuable lesson. All of these verses are a part of the rich wealth that we have, that has been passed down by the Buddha. And so another one that is memorable, reminding us of the inevitability of death and how we don't want to be caught asleep chasing after things that can't possibly satisfy us. So much appreciation for everyone who has undertaken the practice, who has come to request the practice, and does courses in our tradition is our way of providing this opportunity to cultivate that which is valuable. So that's the Dhamma for today. Thank you all for listening.